helpful. No, I'm not going to try anything with the scope, but go ahead.
Okay, so back to you, Paul, but yeah, that was a beautiful program. I think because it's so popular, so well done by Neil deGrasse Tyson, this Nova Science Now, and that particular section on the space elevator, you can Google space elevator and you'll find some very nice websites on the subject. And so as a way of getting hardware into any orbit altitude, but particularly synchronous orbit at altitude, 22,300 miles up, ultimately this is a way of cutting down the cost of putting things up there by maybe numbers like 1,000 to 1. It's going to make a huge improvement in putting things into space. That's the good news. The bad news is the ribbon itself is subject to being struck by meteorites, subject to strong wind disturbances, subject to being struck by aircraft. So the last proposal I heard is you're going to put it offshore at the equator, something like 1,000 miles offshore to the west of South America is the place where they would put the ground station, so to speak, the lower tether for the space elevator. And when the project is running and successful, there are people who think there will be multiple space elevators at multiple locations around the equator of the Earth, because it's going to be such an effective idea. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, they showed dropping the satellite down to the Earth, the ribbon going from the satellite down. I kind of like the idea that we talked about on the net. I think you either read it somewhere or maybe it was your own idea. We have it go out in two directions. Have one go down and then, one go out into space at the same time. I thought maybe they would show it that way, but they didn't. I guess maybe for simplicity, they might have showed it this way, but I think it will probably go the other way in two different directions at one time, one down to the ground, one up. The part I did like, which was informative, was the nanotube topic, the way they described that using graphics with carbon atoms and, showing how these round tube-like structures could be manufactured. They hit the base with, after being heated with argon. Argon has a lot of carbon in it, and they showed how these hair-like fibers, wind up extending from the base material, and then they pull them off, and they come off together. It looks good, but it looks like they got a long way to go. I mean, they just, it doesn't look like they can get much out of it at the present time. They have a lot of work to develop a real ribbon made from this carbon nanotubes. Long way to go with that. And I think that's going to be the main holdback for many years to come. Once they break that one little problem, you might say, I think all heck will break loose there once you develop the ribbon. After that, they'll have probably other issues, maybe with other countries, where they're going to put this, all kinds of deals that have to be probably made with all the different countries around the world. You have this ribbon sticking up in space, and probably down the road you'll have other ribbons. Maybe you'll have two other ones spaced at 120 degrees apart. The complications involving different countries might be a problem. I don't know. But to get this thing off the board, they'll have to develop this ribbon. And it looks like I thought they were further along than what they made it seem. It seems like they've got a long way to go with that thing. But that's all for now. We've got another STS-117 shuttle mission coming up in March. We'll get to that as time goes on. That will be another mission to continue building the space station. I haven't heard anything lately about a mission to save the Hubble, but as of a couple of months ago, that was a go. Mike Griffin, the administrator, is in favor of doing that. So that would be something to look forward to. I hope they do it before any more gyros or any more problems on the Hubble. If that thing becomes unstable, unable to dock with it, it will be a lost cause. But right now it's still operating, still taking pictures. That's pretty much it. The Mars rovers are doing good. I mentioned last week that there was a book by Jim Bell. It's called Postcards from Mars. He picked 150 pictures out of the 150,000 pictures that have come back, which is really a lot of pictures. Now you compare that to the Viking missions. Viking missions, the landers and the orbiter missions combined, I think were 100,000 pictures over a 6 or 7 year period, where here we are only 3 years away, and they have 150,000 pictures back from Mars, which, you know, much more detailed. Look at the cameras on board. They say it's a 1 megapixel camera. And he's often asked, well, what, you know, you can go down to, you know, the nearby store and get a 4 megapixel camera. How come they don't have that on board? And then the guy had to explain that, you know, each component that goes up has to be approved by a test flight, and go through all kinds of tests and everything before it's approved. So a 1 megapixel camera is really what they're up to. I guess in the future they'll have more than that. It's really, I don't think, really needed. If you've ever seen the pictures that have come back, the detail is just phenomenal that they do have in any of these magazines or in this case, a book that you can buy. Very, very good detail of the of what these rovers have done. And more to come when we go into future flights that will be going up there. So back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS2N.
The book that's got selected pictures from, I guess, Spirit and Opportunity, do you already own a copy of that book, and do you know the approximate cost of it, Paul?
No, I don't own it yet, right now it's $40. Was that Borders? I think it was Borders, and I think $36 or something on Amazon.com, so maybe that'll drop a little bit in the near future. But it is a book. It's not just pictures, you know, it's regular book. I'd like to read it. I read a previous book all about the Pathfinder mission with Sojourner. That was really good. So if it's anything like that, I hope it's as technical as that one was. That one gave you a lot of detail involved in the rover and the lander of the Pathfinder / Sojourner mission. I hope this one is like that. If not, I guess the pictures are an explanation of the pictures, which I think is as important as just staring at a bunch of pictures, and also chronologically involved work that the rovers have done from when they landed up until now. That's right there. That's probably worth it. You could spend $35 on almost any piece of junk that, you know, nowadays, that's well worth it. Very educational. I haven't seen the book yet. I can't give you a book report yet, Dick, but it's probably good. It's done by Jim Bell. He was in charge of the cameras that were put on board the Robers. I remember him at the news conferences 3 years ago talking about the cameras and how they operated and how they pitch up, down, and in the interview he was talking about it. They even took pictures of a sun at sunset. They explained why the at sunset the sky is blue, and when you look up in the sky during the day, it's pink, and you have the reverse situation on Earth, and he's pretty good, so it's probably a good book, Dick. That's my guess. Back to you, WS.
Sounds like a fun book. Let's hope it's got some of the information that you and I have seen in that beautiful NOVA series, describing what Steve Squires and others did during the creation of the hardware and the testing of the hardware. I mean, just the section where they were testing the parachute was very extensive to try to make a stable parachute for the Martian atmosphere. It's no easy trick. Beautiful project. If Hubble is one of NASA's most successful pieces of hardware, obviously very high on the list are going to be Spirit and Opportunity, doing extremely well. And it's kind of hard to compare them to the International Space Station. Very different missions, but all quite nicely done. Some good science there. Mel, when I turn it back to you, sorry I had to leave you in a hurry last week. I think we were all going hot and heavy, and at around 10 o'clock I received a telephone call that I just couldn't take. So I gave a quick announcement that I had to take a landline and I was going to be away for a while. But I think I said it on top of somebody, and it probably didn't get heard. So, sorry about that, the way I dropped out on you guys last week. K2KEY, KGYW in the TechNet.
Your excuse, sir. Just bring a note from Mommy. K2RIW in the TechNet, K2KEY. Yeah, I assume that was something of very great importance came up that you had to abruptly take the call. So I did pick up on that, and we did continue the TechNet for a little while further. I still haven't gotten an answer to my question. Is a meteorite, does a meteorite have a high iron content? Because also referring to one of those NOVA programs or similar program that they had on previous week called Wired, if you remember mentioning that this guy was looking for meteorites in fields and using basically one of these metal locators, and he was digging up these meteors, and then he'd put a tool or something next to a shovel, whatever, next to it, that was magnetic or something, and it was sticking to it. So I question, in other words, in order to find a meteorite, as he is doing, does it have to have a metal content so that you can find it, Dick, over?
That I don't know. If someone told me that a high percentage of the meteorites will be detectable with a metal detector, the kind that people use for beachcombing, for instance, to find change in rings and bottle caps and stuff like this, I'd sort of believe that the majority of them will be detectable with a metal detector. But you're really asking, do they all have a high iron content, and therefore can you easily differentiate a meteorite from some other kind of earthbound rock? Well, there are a significant number of earthbound rocks that earth origin rocks, so to speak, which have iron content. So a certain percentage of the rocks that you find on the earth with a metal detector are not going to be meteorites. But if you tell me that you've seen a program that says that it drastically increases the percentage of a proper detection with a couple of false alarms and a couple of missed detects, in other words, I see the possibility of a small number of meteorites not having a high iron content, and I see the possibility of a small percentage of earth rocks having high iron content. So you're going to have a little bit of misdetect, a little bit of false alarm here. but still, I think I'm going to accept the fact that it's a good criteria for finding meteorites in the right place, like, say, Antarctica, with a metal detector. I'd still want to use a good set of eyes, though, to make sure I didn't miss any of them. Back to you, Mel.
Why, I asked, because what I did after I saw that, I got an idea. I take a walk every day on the beach, weather permitting, and there's a lot of stones that are heaved up out of the ocean all winter long before the opening season of the beach. They come and they scrape up all these stones and pieces of wood and all kinds of stuff that come up on a beach. You know, they clean up the whole beach. So I took a magnet I happened to have from a speaker, and it has a screw mount in the back, so I took a plastic rod I have that's about 4 feet, 3.5 feet long or so, and I attached it to it, and give me something to do walking along the beach. I have my headphones on, you know, I listen to some nice classical music I enjoy, and I'm walking along the beach with this magnet, and I'm trying it on all the stones that I see laying along the edge of the ocean there. I figured, no doubt, that number of meteorites most likely fall into the ocean, and I would assume that eventually maybe they get heaped up on the shore with the other stones. But so far I haven't found anything but, like you say, bottle caps, nails, or, you know, things like that. I did find I spotted, so I was looking at a stone. I found one stone I was looking at, it looked so odd, and I just examined it, but laying right next to it was a quarter. And another one I looked at, it was laying next to it, was a penny. So I found 26 cents, so it hasn't been a complete loss so far. But I was trying all these stones. I've been trying it with a magnet so far. I haven't had a magnet stick to any of the stones. I figured if I do, I would, you know, then maybe take the stone with me, and when I'm in the city, stop off maybe at the planetarium. Maybe somebody, you know, would be able to tell me whether or not it's a meteorite or just a, get their common... some kind of common stone on the earth that is has an iron content. So that's why I asked if you know, if this guy is looking for meteorites with him, you know, like you say, one of these metal locators, is the only ones that he finds. In other words, these meteors that he's finding are only ones with a high iron content, I would assume, Dick. Over.
Could be. Although, are there any other metals that a metal detector would find that are not iron that might be in a meteorite? Don't know. Sounds like fun. When I was looking with Google Earth at your house, I think I would travel from your house south on your street until I hit the water, and then go over to the east, as I remember, to get to that beach area, which I think is behind a fence. Is that where you walk? Go ahead.
Roger. Yeah, 2 blocks to my east is the beach. So that's my stomping grounds, as they say. Yeah, it's a quiet beach. You know, it's a small. It's not anywhere, you know, big in size as the Coney Island, Brighton Beach, Coney Island Beach, which stretches for, you know, a number of miles. This is sort of built like sort of on a curve. You know, it's sort of a curved beach. It was a beach, fairly modern beach, because it was only built actually about 30 years ago. So, like I say, I don't have any competition looking for things there, and it was too many people on the beach during the winter time. Only sometimes a person walking a dog lets the dog run loose and has a good time, you know, running along the beach. But other than that, most of the time I have the beach to myself, and so I walk along, like I say, with the magnet, and trying to see if I can find something, that a stone that has some kind of a iron content. But I was only asking that question because the meteorite that this guy, you know, has dug up, every one of them, he shows that, well, he says, see, it's a meteor, because he says he puts this magnet to it and it sticks. And that's why the only reason I assumed that, Dick, but maybe there are others, I don't know, really. I thought maybe somebody on here that, you know, interested in astronomy could answer that question. I have not been able to find an answer to it, Dick. Over.
Comment.
Go ahead. Is that you, Frank?
Yeah, I happened to borrow a metal detector. I'm not into this stuff, but I borrowed it one, and it was a Radio Shack device. I was looking for a pipe in my yard, and I remember from browsing through the manual, it had different settings for not only sensitivity, but different types of metals. It mentioned, you know, ferrous versus aluminum versus copper, whatever. So those instruments detect more than just ferrous things.
Now, do you believe there is significant differentiation there, Frank? In other words, if I set it for aluminum, does it completely reject steel and vice versa? Or does it just make a slight difference in the sensitivities? And I'd really like to know what's going on, because I assume we've got a coil that has a high frequency going through it. When you bring a conducting substance nearby, the eddy current in the conducting substance near the coil changes the apparent inductance, therefore changes the resonance of the coil, and that change in resonance changes the frequency of its oscillation, and therefore if you set it for zero beat, you start hearing a tone in your earphones. That's what I think is going on. And as such, I'm a little bit mystified as to how you can set the controls such that it would differentiate aluminum versus steel. Back to you, Frank, if you happen to know that.
Well, you know, I don't. I was just looking for actually some cast iron soil pipe in my yard, but I'll tell you what. I'm going to borrow the manual, and I'll have it, and we'll see if it says anything about that. I never tried to use it for anything. I just remember the comments, and now that you say that, I'm not sure if they just mentioned that the tone changed with the different metals or whether there were different settings, but I'll borrow the manual, and I'll let you know what it says.
I can see the possibility that if it was a single sideband receiver, you're listening to upper sideband or lower sideband, so to speak. In other words, if I put a non-ferrous metal like aluminum in the coil, it is canceling some of the eddy current. It's creating eddy currents, canceling some of the inductance. Therefore, the frequency of oscillation will go up. And if you had set it for a single sideband, upper sideband detection, you would hear the aluminum. Whereas if you put a ferrous metal in there, it's not decreasing the inductance, it's increasing the inductance. Therefore, the resonant frequency is going to go down. So if you set it for lower sideband reception, this is just a guess on my part, then therefore you'd be able to differentiate an iron-bearing metal from a non-iron-bearing metal. Now, I would be tempted to set it in such a way that it's not zero beat, but you're getting a continuous tone of some kind, like a 1KC note, and therefore I could tell whether the note went up or down, and so any object, whether it be non-ferrous or ferrous, in theory I'd be able to detect it. I'd like to find everything, because there may be a gold-plated iron-bearing ring out there that's very valuable, and so on. I wonder if that's the right method of operation. Is this thing really a sort of a beat frequency oscillator? What do you think, Frank? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's very plausible. I remember, you know, this is over a year ago. I remember the significance was, you know, there was a sensitivity setting and the distance above ground as you sweep with the thing. And then the tones were, in other words, that was one of the clues, was the type of tone. Whether the higher pitch of the tone indicated, you know, one thing or the other. But as I say, I wasn't looking for anything except some old cast iron pipe, and I didn't really use it to find anything else.
Welcome to the W2VL.
How good was it at finding that cast iron pipe in your front yard, Frank?
Well, this was about just to give you an idea, I borrowed it from a guy. This was about a $300 kind of instrument. And I was disappointed because they had a couple of different methods. One was when you were just swinging from side to side to find any metal, and the other was a different technique that was supposed to center it once you found it. And considering that I was looking for 4-inch soil pipe 4 inches down, it wasn't sensitive enough. I was disappointed in the performance. I mean, I found it, but I thought to myself, boy, I wouldn't want to be looking for something smaller.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. So I think you're saying, Frank, there wasn't a great deal of sensitivity left over. In other words, you found your cast iron pipe 4 inches diameter, 4 inches down. But I think you're saying you just barely found it and you had to really work at finding it. Is that what you're saying, Frank?
Yes, and by the way, it was more like 3 feet down. And also, that was one of the things. And also, even when I went off what apparently was the center line, I would get, distractions or changes in the signal. Maybe there was junk in the ground, but I think I was expecting more.
I should go out and borrow a metal detector. I've lost a couple of my sockets from my socket wrench that fell off my belt when I was up the tower on a couple of occasions. They're scattered around my property. Paul, I wonder if you've ever used a metal detector. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I have one. It was, I don't know how many years old this thing is. And I gave it to my daughter when she was small. And it was, inexpensive, maybe $30, 9-volt battery. Not a professional-looking thing at all. Made of metal, made in the USA. But this thing was good. Still is good. And I've used it a number of times. Any kind of metal. I don't notice the difference between an aluminum can or a regular piece of steel. I've used it to look for my backyard and front yard. I found old metal things, old metal pliers that were probably 50 years old that somebody had dropped before the house was even here. Things like that. Bed springs, you can't believe what you're going to find under the ground, Dick, with this thing. In fact, about 2 years ago, I was playing around with it. And I'd say about a foot and a half down, the thing went off, so I started digging down. And I'd say about a foot and a half down, there was a wheel, an old Volkswagen wheel. All rusted up and everything. But it had to be a foot and a half down, Dick. And this thing went off blasting loud, no problem. Not one big loud beep. Every time you come across even a small piece of metal, you'd be able to find sockets, missing sockets, very easily. I remember when they put the roof in my house, I got a new roof put in. And I know they were dropping nails here and there, so when they were long gone, they'd say they got everything. Let me go look. Sure enough, with my metal detector, I found nails that had dropped off the house that I just don't want on the property. No problem, Dick. Just can't detect the difference between, a noise is a noise, whether it's aluminum or steel in my case. Maybe the better ones have a different tone or something to it. But now, if it was a meteorite, and I was looking for something like this guy did, your metal detector would go off, and then if you dig down a foot and there's no other metal or junk in your backyard or out on the beach, wherever you might be, out in the middle of nowhere on a farm somewhere, and you pull out a heavy thing and then you put a magnet to it, you have a good reason to believe that that's probably a meteorite. That's the way that was shown on TV. So you find it with a metal detector, it might be a foot down, and then dig it up if it's magnetic. See, you can't go along with a magnet if the magnet wouldn't work a foot and a half down, Dick. So you go along with your metal detector first before you do that. I lost a piece of 3/8 threaded rod. I was up on the my pipe tower, and I don't know where this thing went. And I wanted to find it. I don't want to hit it with my lawnmower later on. And I know it went pretty far away from the antenna. And a couple of weeks later, I got out there with my metal detector. Sure enough, I found it. It had to be about 25 feet away from where I was working. Like under the fence next to a brick. And sure enough, this thing went off. So they're pretty good. And even the inexpensive ones work good. It's kind of like ham radio. Signals, the signal deck, I wouldn't spend a lot of money on these things. Back to you.
your experience, what is the smallest object do you believe you could find with a metal detector, assuming that object is quite close to the surface?
Roofing nails, pennies, anything like that. I found there's no pop tops or anything like that. I'm sure it would detect that, no problem. I've used it in my house. I could tell where a nail is right through the floor. I could tell you where every nail is over my rug or anywhere in the house. It works real good there.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I was going to say, now, I'm probably giving this thing a bad name, but as I say, all I did was take it in the yard. But I'm going to have to get it back because I remember it had like two concentric circles on the wand on the bottom. I don't know, they were 8 or 10 inches in diameter. But I remember the meter part, and when I say it was complicated, it not only the tone, but it had a meter, and it definitely, I think it even had stuff with coins differentiating. But positively, I remember that it showed, you know, iron, copper, zinc, and so somehow it was able to discriminate between the types of metals, and there were several functions. It even had a notch. I think that was one of the things you were supposed to be able to get, like a null when you were right smack over it and so forth. So it was very sophisticated, and I did not use it except for, 10 minutes out in the yard, and it probably can do a great deal more. But I remember specifically with coins, you would have to set it up above ground in an area, balance it out, and you were supposed to even read the depth of the coin, not only the type of the metal. So I'm sure they do a lot.
How about that? Do you happen to know the brand name of the one that you used, Frank?
You know, I don't, but let me tell you this. Even though he got it at Radio Shack, it was not a Radio Shack product. I want to say Discovery or something like that, because at the time I went on the internet and I found the particular brand that it was like very well known and had all kinds of models and so forth and so on. So it was not a Radio Shack product. It was, I would guess, a fairly well-known detector that they were just selling in the store.
Sounds like a fun thing to have. I do remember borrowing one from somebody once a whole lot of years ago and scanning my property and finding pennies and quarters and dimes and pieces of tin foil and a pair of pliers and things like that, just like Paul did. So there are probably, though, in Brooklyn, an awful lot of beachcombers. That chunk of beach near Manhattan Beach that you were combing as you walk around, Mel, I'll bet you only 10,000 people have scanned that beach in the last 10 years. KQKUY, KQY, WM, back then.
Oh, I never see anybody beachcombing there looking for any kind of treasure. That's why I thought maybe I have, as they say, virgin territory. But every year I look at stuff that gets heaved out of the ocean every year. Some years ago, I knew a plumber that did water mains. And in order to locate the water main, where to dig, they had a gadget called the electronic witch. And as I remember, it was two boxes on it with a sort of like a, they sort of folded together. When they opened up, there was like an arm between them with a handle, with your helmet. And it was supposedly very accurate. And I asked him, he says, well, it cost him a couple of $1,000 at the time. And it had like a, it was like a water bubble or something in the center, which supposedly pinpointed the exact spot of the water main. And I don't know, I guess it worked for them because the water main could be quite deep. It was called Electronic Witch. He said it was the similar device that they make it also for basically their it's a device that they make for the government, for the army, to locate landmines that go over.
Well, I've done some study of landmines, and that's an extremely difficult problem. Thousands and thousands of people every year have limbs blown off in many countries because they're stepping on landmines. Some of the landmines are made out of almost pure non-metallic objects. So detecting landmines and differentiating them from the surrounding soil. Boy, there's been all kinds of techniques. Ultrasonic, infrared, ground-penetrating radar, RF, lots and lots of techniques, acoustic, all kinds of techniques have been used. And each of those techniques are only partially successful. And it's still a very high-risk occupation, no matter what you do. So, darn many landmines exist, darn many people are being injured, and they're so very difficult to detect. Really nasty problem. You can see why Princess Diane was quite moved by that situation and was hoping that she could do something about it. The company I worked for a while considered the possibility of taking their, what they thought was vast 50 years of electronic knowledge and devising the world's best mine detector. And I started collecting internet articles. It turns out every major country in the world, every major institution has attempted to solve this problem. And depending on which article you read, I think I collected altogether 10 inches of paper on that subject. And so lots and lots of man hours have gone into it. It's a tough problem. Back to you, Paul. Mel.
Yeah, I thought somebody else wanted to say something.
Oh, Mel, this is Frank. I wanted to say that this is about 15 years behind the times, but that device that you had was very, very common, used by the water company. And as the newer ones came out, the older ones required connecting to the ground, because when we would work with the water departments, the guys actually liked the older ones. They would just connect the ground lead to the hydrant, and they would work very, very well. And at that point, at least, some of the ones that, you know, were strictly electronic were not so reliable, but I'm going back a lot of years.
Let me ask you this question, Frank. If I'm trying to detect a water main, and some of the really large water mains are non-metallic, I can think of various ways of detecting the fact that the water has a dielectric constant of 81, so it is, at least in dielectric characteristics, quite different from the soil that pipe is buried in. But non-metallic pipes, I'd love to know what their method of detection is, if you happen to know. Back to you, Frank.
I really don't, Dick. Actually, I was in the, I'm retired, but we did utility work, and we were in the sewer and water business, whatever. And going back far enough, some of the water pipe was transite pipe. That was a trade name for Johns Manville, but that was asbestos cement pipe. And then later on or today, you've got a variety of plastics, PVCs that are used. Traditionally, the older cities in the more what we considered quality pipe was cast iron pipe years ago, and then replaced by ductile iron pipe, which is much stronger and less subject to damage from flexing and whatever. But really, I never did anything other than the water companies would come out with their devices. And as I say, I remember the guys that had the old-fashioned ones where they could clip onto a hydrant. They could find the main pretty easily. So that's a question that I can't answer, and I don't know if any of the guys, if there was anything that sophisticated, really.
I wonder if you've ever seen that fancy tool they use, which will allow them to put a new tap into the main. Say, for instance, you erect a new building and you want to establish a new water pipe from the main over to the building. They get this very fancy fixture that drills the hole, installs the fitting, and leaks essentially no water in the process. Very, very fancy device. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, well, for years they've been making what they call, that's termed when you, with a wet tap, when you're just going to put a valve or a line in, and basically in terms of installing a valve on an existing line under pressure, that's been around a long time.
And one of the discussions we've all had is that in many cases, the major grounding for the electrical system within a home uses the water pipes. And so if a person wants to replace the main valve that comes into the house, that can be an extremely dangerous procedure. If the person doesn't make electrical contact on both sides of the pipe that he's about to separate when he replaces that valve, because there are some cases where the 2300 volt line that's going to the step down transformer on the utility pole in front of your house, 7600 volts, 2300 volts, in some cases that return is taking place by the homeowner's grounding system. And there have been a number of cases of somebody not realizing what's happening by making some measurements ahead of time to see that there was current flowing in that water pipe. And so you open up that junction with one hand on each side, and the 7600 volts appears across your two hands, an extremely unpleasant experience. Your chances of survival are not good. I think we've already had this discussion. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY. K2RIWM
is TechNet. Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, the problem with landmines, there's a guy that came up, they were showing on television with this vehicle. He's producing this special vehicle that looks like a big boiler. That's the only way I can explain. It's got a heavy reinforced body on it, and the wheels look like drums, heavy drums made out of boilerplate or something, and that's what they're using now. He said this is the best way to clear an area of land. It's very easy to drive, and he just drives over a piece of land back and forth, and if there's any landmines, they explode, but of course they can't damage this vehicle. I take over.
Yeah, that's a brute force approach, which I think during the D-Day invasion, there was a fancy tool invented, I think, by the Brits, which had a great big drum with a bunch of chains attached to it, and this thing spun around very fast, and it would literally beat the ground in front of the vehicle with these flinging chains on this drum as a method of exploding landmines. So, maybe the brute force approach is one of the best, although I see the possibility of a certain kind of a mine that might not be exploded by these techniques, but still could be carefully tuned for the signature of a human being walking over it, and therefore still only explode when the human being is there. Really nasty weapon, landmines. It's got to be a better way. Anybody else want to discuss anything of interest to ham radio operators? Give us your call letters at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
One quick comment for you, Dick.
Go ahead, Paul. Frank.
Yeah, I didn't comment at the time, but when you asked me about that device, I have to tell you a quick story because it could save somebody a lot of money. Normally, the homeowner, at least in most Jersey communities, the homeowner is responsible from the curb in. In other words, there's a water main in the street, there's a service going to your curb with a curb stop, and then from the curb line to your home, if there's a problem, you call the plumber. Well, in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, a shore community where I happen to have a place, for some reason the homeowner is responsible to the middle of the street. Now, I've been down there about 40 years. Anyway, make a long story short, the copper line from the water main in the street to my house developed a leak. And I literally became responsible to go to the main. And when I inquired, I was looking at $3,000 or $4,000 was the cheapest quotes that I got. I got a hold of a foreman that used to work for us. I was retired and out of business out of the time. And to make a long story short, he bought a gadget similar to what you're talking about that you could put on a water service. He didn't even have it. Went down to a big plumbing supply house and for 100 and some odd bucks bought it, and I ended up with a $400 or $500 job instead of a $4,000 or $5,000 job.
Now, what's not clear is that this device that you bought allowed you to find the leak and therefore put some kind of a patch over the leak, as opposed to replacing the whole pipe for a few thousand dollars.
I didn't make that clear. It was not a device to find it, but the water main in the street, which was nearly on the other side of the street, was an 8-inch main. I would have had to have a contractor dig across the street from my house to the water main, make a connection to the water main with the, it probably was just 1-inch coppered line, coming to the curb where the curb stop, which was sitting in my driveway, which was actually what was leaking. But the point was it was leaking, and if you removed it, you would have had the full pressure of the 8-inch main squirting through the 1-inch line. This was a device that clamped over the 1-inch circuit, over the 1-inch service, and permitted him to cut the service, and it would clamp off the pressure side, and then he reconnected a new copper line to go to my house and removed it. So it was just something that allowed inserting a 1-inch copper curb stop under pressure.
Interesting. So somehow this thing captured the pipe as it cut it and prevented a tremendous amount of leaking. Now, I've heard of plumbers who will use various techniques for freezing the water that's in the pipe right in front of the valve they're going to replace when they replace a main service valve, and by freezing a plug by, I guess, with dry ice or something like this, or I'm not quite sure how they did the freezing, but by freezing the pipe, they create a temporary blockage so that when they open up the main, a tremendous amount of water doesn't flow out. I guess you can only do that a small number of times, because each time you create a frozen plug, you're creating expansion, which is deforming the copper pipe a little bit in that area. I wonder if you've ever heard of that technique, Frank. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard of it, Dick, but actually I never saw it employed, or, you know, don't know anything beyond what you've just said.
Sorry, Dick.
Okay, let's hear about it.
Believe it or not, it's a little throwaway kit. It's a one-shot. Comes with a thing that you wrap around the pipe, a jacket, a hose, a short hose, and a tank they give you filled with, I guess, I don't know what's under pressure in that tank, but you turn it on and it freezes the line. And then how he did it, I watched him do it. He takes a hacksaw. I watched the, after is about 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes. Then he takes the hacksaw, he starts cutting the line a little bit to see if there's any water flow. If there's no water flow, you just continue cutting off. You cut the line off and then add in the new connector or whatever you're putting in there. And then you take this thing off and it defrosts, doesn't distort the line or anything, and you throw it away. It's a one-shot. It's a kit. They sell it, I guess, plumbing supply. I think he said you can get them in Home Depot now, Dick, over.
The tank, I'm going to guess the tank maybe contains compressed carbon dioxide. That one, it expands, or is it dry nitrogen? Where do you think now? Yeah, carbon dioxide, I think it is. When carbon dioxide expands, I think it gives you minus 70 degrees centigrade compressed carbon dioxide. Roughly how big was the tank, and what did that blanket look like, Mel?
Tank was the size of a propane bottle. a regular propane bottle. The jacket that goes around it was a flexible thing. It looked like almost like a cuff that you would put around your arm to check the blood pressure. That's what I thought it was at first. Basically, it almost attaches the same way. And it really worked. I was watching. He turned it on and all. He watched his watch after about 15 minutes. He says, okay, he took a hacksaw, made a little cut, no water coming out, just continued cutting off the pipe about a foot or so from this thing, and put a new coupling on there and hooked it up to a main valve, replaced a section of that, cut out the main valve and all, but put a coupling in there and with a main valve and all, and that's it, took the jacket off, and a little while later, maybe about 10, 15 minutes of water, you can hear it start to flow, and all of a sudden, that's it. And that's all to it. It comes in a little box, Dick. Like I say, it looks like definitely like a propane tank. The only way I describe it. and the cup is what you look like, you exactly like you would use to take blood pressure, over.
WS2N.
Yeah, when you get a chance, Mel, I'm going to ask you what you think the price of that is. Go ahead, Paul.
On some of the older pipes years ago, before they got involved with all the different ways of doing it, by the way, before 1990, before the Montreal deal, you know, before that you could just bend Freon into the air. They used to take rags wrapped around a pipe, and you take a Freon tank, like even Freon 12 or 22, and you take the open line and stick it into these rags and open up your tank and instantly freeze your pipe, and then they do a repair like that. That's illegal, since 1990, when all the countries got together and said you can't vent this stuff into the air anymore. But before all of this, back in the dry ice days, which was a popular means of doing that, some of the small lines, like half inch, wanted to do like a little half inch line, copper line, they would take white bread, take all the ends off the white bread, stuff the white bread into the half inch pipe, right? And then that would temporarily stop the leak like a plug. And then attach a valve, quick solder that. And then take your torch and heat up the bread on the inside. And eventually would turn to toast. Now you got your valve open now, and then this would flake off, and just like a dried up crusty toast would shoot through the pipe, and that would clear the line. You could do that on a domestic line years ago. Back to you, Dick.
I'm amazed that bread would do that. Wow. Now, I got two questions for you, Mel. One, what do you think the kick cost? And second of all, out here in Suffolk County, if I wanted to do a major job on the water supply in my house, I would try to get somebody to close off the valve in the street, which in my case is 20 feet from the street, so to speak, 15 feet from the street. Where the water meter is, there's an on-off valve. What makes a person not use that? Back to you, Mel.
Service line from the house to the main, there is no cutoff valve, that's easily accessible. In other words, there's not a cover or something that you can open up and, turn a valve. They only got a cutoff for the whole block down in the corner there, which the only way you can get to that, use that, is you have to apply to the Department of Buildings, Department of Water Supply. So if it's just the line that goes to your house, I watched them put a new one in. In fact, next door they built a new house, and they went to the main. Before they took down the old house, they had to shut off the water, so they did dig up the street temporarily to turn off that valve that's buried. And then after the house was, as being put up to put the new service line in, they dug the street up again to open the valve, put the new line in and open the valve. But if it's just the valve, I'd say the turnoff valve in the house in the basement, the only way you're going to change that valve is to freeze it, Dick. You can't get to the turnoff valve in the street without digging up the street, over.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, that's not quite true. If you picture this, your main in the street is whatever it may be, say a 6-inch diameter main, and let's just say you have a 3/4-inch or a copper line coming off that main to the curb, and there is a valve, a shutoff valve, with one family residences right at your curb in front of the house. It's termed a curb stop, but it's down 3 or 4 or 5 feet, whatever the depth is, and you may have seen people from the water company come with what they call a key. It just turns 90 degrees, but the point is you have a curb stop at the curb, so your plumber can come, he can shut the water off at the curb, so there no longer is any water flowing from the curb to the inside where your shutoff valve is. My problem down at the shore was the curb stop was defective, so there was no way to shut the water off coming in. But, you know, I don't know about multi residences in the city, but typically every single family residence has a curb stop in front of the house.
Yeah, I've got that, but apparently Mill does not. To my knowledge, each one of the private homes in my community have a cover plate. You open it up, you go down a few feet, you see both a water meter and a cutoff valve. Back to you, Mel.
Don't have it here in Brooklyn. We have a water meter that's in the basement right off the cutoff valve. After that, there's the water meter. It's in the basement. And from there out, there is no covers or anything like that. Any place around here that they have to service the main, you got to do digging. And there's out to the street. The pipe is, they dug up. It's about 2 foot from the curb out into the street that they seem to dig at that point to get, that's where the main is located. The main is not located, in other words, the main is located out from the curb. It doesn't run along the exact curb area. So it's everywhere here. They've been chopping holes in the street. They've got to come along with a jackhammer and chop a hole in the street and then dig down quite a bit, because they have to shore up. I see they shore up the hole when they go down there, take over.
Yeah, I sure hope that my line drop to my house never needs replacement, because the main in my street is on the opposite side of the street. They'd have to go under my street to replace that main. Okay. Do you think there's any other subjects we should be discussing tonight, Mel? Back to you, sir.
Well, I got two interesting things that we were hitting upon. There was one or two things I got a lot of emails, very nice emails, about last week, how we did the math, you know, how to determine from rectangular to polar, and also the method I basically outlined of taking, you know, measurements at the antenna R and X, and how to simply compute the SWR with a quadratic. And the fact that one of the comments was that he showed it to his teacher, and his teacher says, "I never saw this before. What book did he get it out of?" And I, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I don't remember where I got that from. I got a new flashlight, I was going to tell you, when you were talking about light. The flashlight is 1 inch in diameter and 4.5 inches long. It contains four AAA batteries, four of them, in a little round turret type device that comes out the back. You unscrew it, the back cover of this thing, and you take it out. The light consists of 8 LEDs in a circle and a laser, a red laser in the middle that you push the button once, the regular lights come on, and boy, this is really a lot of light. It really does light up the area with all these LEDs. And then you push the button a second time, and on comes the laser. Push it a third time, and everything shuts off. Actually, you push the button once, the lights come on. Push it a second time, the lights go off, the laser comes on, and then you push it the third time, and that's all, everything off. And then I'm going to tell you about another gadget. I don't know if you've seen this flashlight so far, over.
Yeah, I'm looking at a flashlight that I own right now, which has got 7 LEDs, and the thing is super bright. It runs on, I think mine runs on C cells. I've got another one that runs on double A's, I think it is, that's got 4 LEDs. So these super bright, super efficient, brand new light-emitting diodes are starting to make great flashlights. They're starting to appear as the stoplights on automobiles, the backup lights, the stoplights, and so on. So making light without incandescent bulbs is becoming a brand new science. Back to you, Mel.
Well, this one is nice. It's really pocket-sized. It's only 1 inch in diameter, 4.5 inches long, but only 1 inch in diameter. So it is really a terrific light. I was at Floyd Bennett's this past week. We had a meeting, and a number of people had come to the meeting, had never been up to, you know, that control tower. So I took them up there at night, and of course none of the lights work up there to speak of. So I turned this light on, and I was able to would keep, you know, the place fairly well illuminated with just this pocket light. It's amazing that the amount of light that comes out of this thing, how they, you should see how clever they